Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. Our show today is part of our series on breakthrough solutions, demonstrating that seemingly difficult situations or problems actually have solutions, and those are working in the world right now. Today's show is a little bit different topic about birthing, about how young spirits enter the world, about how women are treated when they're about to deliver the next generation as a gift to our nation and our planet. Here with us today to talk about some breakthrough approaches in birthing and pregnancy care is Alexandra Evangelibi, a California licensed midwife, founder and clinical director of the Sanctuary Birth and Family Wellness Center, where Stuart Fishburne works in collaboration with a team of midwives. The Sanctuary is a one-of-a-kind center where families are cared for from preconception, prenatally, through the birth and postpartum, while experiencing a number of classes designed to help meet the needs of new parents. Alex and her business partner, Bliss Young, teamed up to help transform the way that birth is managed in this country by creating a sustainable model of optimal maternity care that would far surpass the standards that most women receive today. Their hope is that the Sanctuary will be the gold standard that will reproduce in other cities so that thousands of other families have the opportunity to experience such amazing care. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hi. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, thank you so much for being willing to be my guest today. And just so our listeners know, I mentioned that you work in collaboration with Dr. Stuart Fishbein, who's a Maryland, who's an MD, OBGYN, and he'll be joining the call in about 15 minutes. So
yes.
tell us a little bit. I'm intrigued by this model that you have about, you know, how are women and families treated around pregnancy and kind of what are you doing here?
Well, you know, I think the easiest way to really see the differences in what we provide versus what's a standard option available is to really look at the countries that already have this model in place where midwives are working with low-risk women and obstetricians manage the higher-risk candidates. In countries throughout Europe and Holland, Amsterdam, we have much better statistics overall. England, women are typically cared for by midwives, either doing home birth or hospital care, and then doctors manage the clients that have higher risk conditions, you know, and we have much better outcomes statistically in the countries that follow that model of care. So we have, at the Sanctuary Birth and Family Wellness Center, adopted that model. And what we're finding is that in a collaborative care practice where we can rely on the obstetricians to consult with us and co-manage care when it's a bit out of our scope, our clients are having far better outcomes. And we're able to keep women more low risk who otherwise might end up being managed by obstetricians. So what, you know, there's an analogy and it goes something like this. Women who are healthy, low risk, it's like them giving birth with an obstetrician is very similar to having a pediatric cardiologist babysit your child.
Yeah, so let's take a step back on this because I know historically for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, it was the midwives who were caring for the pregnant women and delivering the babies. And then there was a shift with the whole scientific revolution and the growth of technology in the, particularly from the 19th century on, everything kind of got medicalized, and there was the shifting away from the midwives and the herbalists into more doctors and more technology. So that shift kind of happened everywhere. And when we started with the medical schools, they excluded women, so we ended up with the male doctors. And what had traditionally been the source of nourishment and care for the women kind of got pushed by the wayside there. But what it sounds like here is that you're kind of bringing back in a new and a fresh and exciting way the important role that midwives can play in helping pregnant women and their families.
Absolutely. I mean, the care that we provide is so far-reachingly different than what is typically being offered. And I think most women today, you know, they look at their insurance card and they go to the OB that's on their card, and they'll typically wait about an hour and a half for their prenatal appointment, of which they'll spend 7 minutes with a doctor, because that's pretty much doctors can allot for each client. And they might get their ultrasound, they might get their blood drawn, but there's really no care. You know, our OB said he never got 1 hour of one class in 8 years of medical school training discussing nutrition. And we all know that nutrition can severely impact the well-being of a woman while she's pregnant. So
wait a minute. Let's just hold on. That you're saying that the medical doctors don't get any training in nutrition. Did you just say that?
I did say that.
Because, you know, that's very interesting to me. When I was in college at Yale, I was an undergraduate, but I was very interested in nutrition for a variety of reasons, looking at the problem of world hunger. And I know we had the Yale Medical School, and I was absolutely shocked at that time that doctors had no training in nutrition, which is just so essential in, you know, building up our bodies and being strong. So I actually set up a seminar on nutrition that was available to the medical staff and students. But I'm just amazed that here we are all these years later, and that's still the case, that doctors are not trained in nutrition. That's very scary.
Well, this was also 25 years ago when he went to medical school, so there could have been a change. However, you know, this is, you know, still the body of most obstetricians are not taking the time to counsel their patients about what they're eating. You know, for midwives, we spend an hour with each appointment with our clients, so we really get to know them on many different levels. You know, we're definitely talking about what they're eating. We're talking about what kind of exercise they're getting, what kind of stress levels they're under, how much water they're drinking. I mean, there's just really no time inside standard maternity care models for those conversations to take place, which, you know, helps an OB who's really a specialist in problems of pregnancy. When the fire happens, they're great at putting them out. But midwives are much better at seeing like the little tinders and the sparks of the fire well before they turn into an inferno. And we can counsel our clients on how to really be responsible for the outcome, such that they're able to, you know, acknowledge, okay, yeah, I can see that stress is impacting my experience, or maybe the lack of exercise might be causing this baby to get in a funky position. Here's what I can do to make a difference in my pregnancy right now. And it's far more empowering a model. It puts the responsibility back into our clients' hands. We can counsel them, but they ultimately can make the choices which are going to impact their experience. You don't get any of that kind of education in the standard maternity model. You really have to seek outside in order to impact your experience, if you're even of the ilk to really explore those things.
Right. Well, some of this is this part of the thing. If we do some good preventive care on the front end, we can prevent a lot of expensive and dangerous problems down the road.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, nutrition and exercise will impact the outcome of the baby's growth. Mm-hmm. It'll impact the well-being of the mother. It'll impact experiences of postpartum depression. It'll impact, you know, healthy lactation. There's, you know, small changes that a woman can make in her pregnancy to make a huge difference for herself and for her baby.
Right. Wonderful. So, you know, walk us through, say I'm a pregnant woman and I come into your sanctuary there, you know, what happens? Like, what is the care? Walk us through it.
So people may come in prior to conceiving. You know, I think today's couples are interested in really exploring their options, largely in part of Ricky Lake's movie that came out, The Business of Being Born. And she recently came out with another one, More Business of Being Born. And what her movie documented was what's actually really happening. So this documentary got out and women and couples really started looking into their birth options. So often we'll meet people early on who aren't even pregnant yet, who are looking at how to prepare their bodies in such a way that they're going to have a healthier conception, healthier pregnancy, and really feel connected to their care providers. So, you know, we're able to kind of roll out the red carpet, so to speak, for the actual environment of conception, which has, you know, we know that environment has a tremendous impact on our well-being. And when you look at the statistics for autism today, I personally really believe that environment has a lot to do, the prenatal environment, with how healthy the fetus is actually going to be.
Could we just loop in on that? That's critical, because this thing about autism is just exploding. This, you know, dramatically more children experiencing the condition of autism. And what's your sense of where that's coming from? I know some people say it's about, you know, the mercury and the medicine that's being given for the inoculations. I've heard a lot of different theories. You're working closely with the women, the mothers, the babies. What's your sense of what's happening? Why is autism so much more prevalent today?
I think there's a lot of factors that are all working together. For one, you know, I believe that many of us are, you know, we take away the birth control pill and we are ready to get pregnant without really looking at the state of the body. Bruce Lipton, he's a cellular biologist. He's one of my favorite authoritarians on the subject, and he says that the conception is actually determined 2 to 3 months before the egg and the sperm actually meet. So for some people, they're like, you know what, I'm going to stop drinking and try and get pregnant in a couple months, or I'm going to, you know, start eating better. But the environment that they are actually starting with is often very toxic. You know, I mean, we all hear about the babies that were conceived after a really fun night, you know, and, you know, so many of us are oopses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like one very clear foundational place that you have to come from. Okay, so what is actually going on in the body? Many of us are never looking. We don't really even know. We don't know what toxins are in our system. We don't know what deficiencies are present. We really just have no clue what the environment is that conception is happening in. And, you know, I think there's some grace in that, you know, conception has been happening since time began. So it does typically work even inside of environments that really aren't ideal. But then there's exposures during the pregnancy that a woman, you know, comes into contact to. There's teratogens, which are chemicals in our environment that cross the placental barrier. You know, I've had several clients who are hairdressers who end up having babies with birth defects. And these are women who are exposed to a higher number of chemicals. Last September, I had 3 clients that had ear, nose, throat defects. That's outrageous. Something was happening at the time of development to these women who were all situated in the same area, that there was an exposure in that same exact stage of development for each of those babies. And, you know, this is anecdotal evidence. It'll be years before we can really get these studies out, and there needs to be a lot of money being put into these studies in order for us to get very clear, effective information. But, you know, anecdotally from what I've seen in my practice, you know, there are things that are part of the conception process, the preconception process, the prenatal period of development, and during the birth itself, exposures, chemicals, you know, something like 70% of women get Pitocin in labor now. how that affects the sensitive neurologic development of a baby at that critical, vulnerable time, it's going to be years before we see the long-term impacts. But again, all of these things are cumulative in nature. So we also have a genetic predisposition that makes us more sensitive to any number of these exposures, whether it's during the birth process or if it's in the early time of conception. It's starting to affect us. You know, we're dealing with something like 1 in 55 kids is on the autistic spectrum. And if we continue at this rate, I think in 20 years, it's supposed to be 1 in 20 kids.
Right. So, it wasn't that long ago. It was 1 in 100 just a few years back.
1 in 10,000.
Right.
A few years before that.
Right. Exactly right. Wow. That's really fascinating. So when a pregnant woman comes into your center, you're obviously aware of all these kind of potential chemical toxic problems that could create difficulty for the fetus, for the baby when the baby is born. So what's your environment like for the woman who comes in to work with you at the Sanctuary Wellness Center?
Well, you know, we can't, as far as our environment, I mean, it's beautiful. Everything we do, you know, we minimize any kind of exposure to anything artificial. You know, we do a lot of counseling with our clients, specifically about their homes, what products they are cleaning with. I mean, coming into our space, you're going to spend an hour here, but it's your space that's most relevant. And, you know, we want everything that they put on or in their bodies to be as gentle and mild as possible. You know, there's so many beauty products out there. I tell my clients, if you're not willing to put that in your mouth, you shouldn't be putting it on your body. Your skin is your biggest digestive organ. So really look at your labels and start to make more discerning choices, such that you're going to minimize your exposure to toxins as much as possible. Diet and nutrition. I mean, it's probably the cornerstone of midwifery care. We spend, you know, most of our time counseling our clients on how to be the ones making the best choices about their nutrition. It's one of the reasons why midwives have so such great statistics. We have the fewest gestational diabetes or, you know, preeclamptic clients, because we can, like, really counsel them to take a lot of responsibility in their health. Usually when people come into our care, they will, by the time they come out, they'll be healthier than ever in their lives because
Wonderful.
Of the time we take with them. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And what a great way for a child to enter the world with that level of care and, you know, toxic-free, loving embrace that you're providing. Is Dr. Fishbein on the line?
You know, I just got a text from him. He has a client in labor, I believe, and has to rush to a birth.
All right. So he's not going to join us today then. Okay. Wonderful. Well, I'm glad that he's out doing his thing. You know, there's so many ways that this makes sense. You know, it's kind of the loving, nurturing, holistic care that you're giving to the pregnant woman. You know, the warm, welcoming, safe environment that you're creating for the infant as the infant comes into the world. But there's also a very practical benefit on this. You know, if a woman takes more of this kind of approach to pregnancy and birth, isn't it a big cost savings? I mean, don't we get this better care for less money than what the typical model is?
Well, you know, yes, that's the short answer. The long answer is, again, for us, it's not about one day of your life. It's about counseling people to make better choices for the long term and to be more empowered parents. You know, the standard hospital birth costs somewhere between maybe $15,000 unmedicated. You're out of there that day or the next day, no overnight stay. Where most typically it's somewhere in the $30,000 to $50,000 range. A standard out of hospital birth with all the hours that we spend with our clients And usually after an hour interview with a client who's exploring their options, I tell them, I'm like, look, we just spent more time together than you will with your OB your entire care.
Wow.
We usually just in that charge
visit.
Just in that first visit. And, you know, the standard cost for out-of-hospital birthing is somewhere between, you know, depending on what part of the country you're in, $3,000 to maybe $6,000. And that includes all your prenatal care, the birth, all the postpartum care, which, you know, is several visits with a midwife. And, you know, I'm still getting pictures from my clients of belly buttons and rashes and, you know, months after they've delivered. You know, after a woman gives birth with her OB, which she'll likely spend 1 hour with her obstetrician the entire actual day of delivery, he says, okay, or she says, I'll see you in 6 weeks at your six-week postpartum visit. So there's no real postpartum care that's happening, which is a huge reason why women who are having difficulty breastfeeding give up. You know, they don't have the support postpartum to encourage them to continue on. They don't have people educating them about their benefits. There's certainly no childbirth classes necessarily happening unless they're offered by the hospital, and those are often very limiting in their scope. It really teaches you how to be a good patient in a hospital. Instead of, hey, these are your options, this is what's going to impact you having a better experience in this environment. There's no real resourcing for those things.
And that's part of the cost savings is, you know, the need for a medical doctor is less because the, you know, you as the midwife and the team of people that you're working with provide kind of most of that care. And for most things connected to birth, we don't really need a doctor, right? Or do you have a doctor available on site or on call when a woman actually goes into labor?
Well, Dr. Fishbein is a doctor that we would use to consult with during a client's prenatal care. So if we're getting lab values that are, you know, unusual for us, or if we have a concern about some symptoms, we might speak with him and run this test or run that test. Or if we're concerned about the way a baby's developing, we would have him do some ultrasound just to check. So it's that piece of collaboration that has what we do works so well. But, you know, in terms of the transporting or going to a hospital, we have great relationships with obstetricians in the area so that when we need to go to a hospital, we have those options readily available for our clients, and we've already figured out, based on insurance, where we're going to go and who we're going to see. So there's really no guesswork for us. And, you know, because we're not using drugs in labor to push past the body's natural processes, we don't see the situations where a baby's going from sounding great in labor to terrible. And, you know, the big what if, you know, you often hear the question. I mean, every time I interview clients, the first thing they're like, well, what if there's an emergency?
Exactly, we're
trained to think that birth is an emergency. We're trained to think that it's a scary event, that it's not a natural process, and that it needs help. Right now in this country, 35% of women having babies have C-sections. That's one in three.
1 in 3 women are not having
a successful vaginal birth. You cannot tell me that 1 in 3 women can't do this. We didn't get this far in our evolution with that statistic. We would have far fewer people on this planet if birth didn't work well.
Why is it so high? You know, is this, you hear the stories about the OBGYN say, well, labor's taking too long, I want to get to the golf course. And, you know, it's just kind of the convenience of the scheduling in terms of the staff at the hospital. But, you know, why is it so high?
There's so many reasons. You know, I mean, for a long time, we've been following, the medical model has been following something called the Friedman's curve. Somebody named Dr. Friedman basically was like making these assessments and assumptions that a woman should dilate at a centimeter an hour. Well, we know that women don't often do that. Like sometimes women plateau at 6 centimeters and they hang out there for 4 hours and then they start dilating again. But in a hospital setting, when women come in, it's very disruptive for that primal limbic part of their brain to function, which is the part of us that's most active when we're in labor. Women in labor are not very cognitively aware. They, in order for those hormones to really be effective, need to shut down the cortex of their brain. They need to silence the part of their brain that's thinking and planning and concerned about different things. If the cortex is operating, you know, it's the part of our brain that's like, I need to pay the IRS taxes. Oh my gosh, I didn't schedule the pediatrician appointment. I wonder if the car seat's in the car. Is it hooked in? You know, that part of our brain, that thinking, planning, organizing part, it has to shut down. The limbic part of our brain is really more responsible for the hormones and the sensation. And that is when our instinct works really well, is when that part of the brain takes over. So, you know, it's very easy for me to describe in a home birth or in the birth center when women come, we're not talking to them. We're not asking them what they ate, when the last time they went to the bathroom, if they took their vitamins that day. We create a space, since we have this relationship with them, we know our clients so well. We allow them the freedom and the space to do what they need to do to birth their babies. And, you know, we don't force them to get into different positions. We're not keeping them from eating or drinking. In a hospital setting, the first thing that happens when a laboring woman gets there, she's asked 50 questions that are kind of irrelevant to what's happening right now in the moment. And in all those questions, she's got to think about an answer. And when she thinks about it, she's now moving back into her cortex. And now contractions start to space out. But now you're at the hospital, and they kind of have to do something. So they start by, you know, augmenting labor. They give a woman an IV. She can't eat or drink. She has to stay in the bed so that the baby can be monitored. All of these things are interrupting the natural flow of hormones and catecholamines and all the things that make labor happen.
It's like the natural flow gets interrupted by all the mechanization.
Exactly. I mean, think about mammalian birth, you know, when you have an animal that's in labor. Anybody who's had cats or dogs, when the cat goes to have their kittens, they go under the bed in the closet in a dark, safe, quiet space. There's no other dogs coming up to them asking them, what are you doing? How's it going? You know, it's, you know, they step away from the pack and they go and they do their thing. And if suddenly there's a predator around, labor stops. They get up and they run away.
Okay, so hold that thought. We need to pause now for a break. This is Eleanor Lacaine speaking with my guest, Alexandra Evangelidi, the founder and clinical director of the Sanctuary Birth and Family Wellness Center. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine speaking with my guest, Alexandra Evangelidi, a licensed midwife and founder and clinical director of the Sanctuary Birth and Family Wellness Center. We were talking just before the break about how giving birth is a very natural experience, but over the past century and a half or so, it's become very medicalized. And, you know, it's become more the norm that women will give birth in a hospital as opposed to in their home. But talk to us now about, you know, why would anyone have a home birth when hospitals are so much safer if something goes wrong?
Well, the reality that a hospital is a safer place is a perceived notion of safety and not based on accuracy. I mean, and that's really the truth. It's been presented in many studies. There was a really big study printed in the British Medical Journal in 2007, and it looked at 5,000 women who were choosing to give birth out of the hospital and 5,000 women who were choosing to give birth in the hospital. The same population of women, everybody was low risk. The outcomes of the study was that of the women who began to give birth at home, who that was their original choice of vocation, there was a 5% C-section rate. And of the women who chose to give birth in the hospital, there was a 24% C-section rate. There were fewer interventions used in a home birth setting, and there was a much greater experience of enjoyment during the birth process when they started by giving birth at home. So, you know, I think there's this conversation in our culture, this, you know, belief that birth is an emergency, that birth is a bomb waiting to go off. And this is what we're taught. And this is what we're infused with when we look at media representations of birth. It's scary. It's overwhelming. It's such a big event, and it's really out of control. These are the messages that we're getting. You know, we don't see too many sensual, quiet, peaceful imageries in birth when we look at the media. You know, it's really, in so many ways, it's bastardized to be this event that, you know, you just don't know what could go wrong. And in fact, we don't know what can go wrong, but the likelihood of something going wrong is so small, but it's really given us, the images that we're getting are much different than that.
We get in a car every day and we could have an accident, but we, you know, it's kind of, no one really worries about that. You just go driving.
This is true. But with birth, because it's such a unusual event in our lives, like, you know, you might give birth once or twice. You get in a car every day.
Right. Yeah, that is a great description of the imagery around it. And what percentage of births now are home births versus hospitals? Do you know, kind of nationwide?
Yeah, it's about 1.2%.
No way.
Out of hospital, yeah.
No way. Yeah. 1.2% at home and 99% in hospitals?
Yes.
Holy cow. I thought there was a reverse trend, you know, in the past decade or so of more women doing the midwife route.
There is. But it used to be 1%. Now it's 1.2%. So it's risen 20%.
Well, there's a big growth opportunity here.
Yeah.
And how do you think we can increase the number of women who realize that this is an option and this is kind of a good way to go?
Well, I think, you know, this radio show is a start, and educating women, you know, educating couples, really watch the movie, The Business of Being Born. I mean, absolutely, if you are pregnant or planning to get pregnant or know somebody that's pregnant or have a daughter, you know, people need to educate themselves about the reality of what it's going to be like inside of the standard maternity care option. People need to look at what their options are. Educate yourself. I mean, you know, you can say that about anything. But the more that we educate ourselves about anything that is, you know, a part of our lives, the more we're going to empower ourselves to make choices that are better for us. So, you know, in terms of this particular topic, read. There's tons of books. Ina May Gaskin, who's kind of like the grandmother of modern midwifery, she started the farm in Tennessee probably about 40 years ago. She's written two beautiful books, Ina May's Guide to Childbirth and Spiritual Midwifery. There are tons of beautiful movies out there that have come out to really show what's possible in the birthing process. And, you know, I completely realize that out-of-hospital birth is not for everybody. You know, it takes somebody who's really interested in having information, being somewhat in charge, because, you know, how are we ever really in charge when it comes to this process? But who want to have the say and how things go in their birth, and who possibly are interested in creating some sanctity back inside of this process. I mean, it is absolutely a zenith experience that we will get to have if we choose to give birth. And there's so much available for us as women, and for our partners as well. And if we have older children, to be able to witness this mm-hmm. event, the sacredness and the power and the potency in the authentic, the extraordinary nature that birth has the potential to be. Mm-hmm. And it can impact so many people for the rest of their lives. You know, I have clients who come to interview me who are born at home, and the way that they talk about birth is so different than people who haven't had that experience. Or, you know, maybe they saw their younger siblings born at home, and again, the way they trust birth, they trust this process, and we've kind of isolated the experience of birth in our culture so that it's so undercover. It's like in the dark closet. People don't really talk about it.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I see the same thing at the beginning of life and at the end of life. You know, both my parents have passed away in the past few years. And I saw, particularly when my father passed away, it's a very sacred moment. You know, death is a natural part of life. And obviously you want to do what you can to help the person live as long as, you know, possible and be comfortable. But it was such a medical experience. I was in the hospital. It was clear he was dying. They kept doing all these things to keep him alive. It was like he was so miserable and in pain. It was just, it was like, what is the point? It's a, just, there is that time you reach where it's the passing of the season and it's time to let go. And I was very grateful to hospice because they had a hospice wing in the hospital where you could actually, you know, connect, you know, disconnect from the medicalization of the whole thing and really relax into the passing of the life and the sanctity of the moment. So I'm so glad you're restoring that at the front end when babies are being born into the world. What a miracle.
Well, I think it's the same thing what the hospice people do, you know? They are uh-huh. restoring life's passages. They're two profoundly beautiful moments that, you know, that the culture of the hospital does not know how to contain and respect. And uh-huh. that has long-standing implications in our culture. We've become a technocratic society, and technology has almost completely ruled how we come into this world and how we leave it. And, you know, it's sad. It takes away from the beauty and the profound nature of the experience.
Right, exactly right. So, you know, why wouldn't every woman want to do this? And, you know, we obviously there can be great pain in childbirth. I guess part of the attraction with the modern medicine is that they have the drugs that would take the pain away, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I had a conversation with a client at a health food store the other day, and she asked me that very question. She's like, why do I want to feel this? She's uh-huh. like, my mother said to me, take the drugs. Uh-huh. You know, and I think that, you know, and I come from my own perspective on this, but, you know, if you look at evolution, we have not evolved past the pain in childbirth. So we have to assume that it plays a role and a function in the process itself. When a woman is unmedicated and she's in labor and she's having her contractions, she's also producing all these other endorphins, morphines, we call them. Like her body is having the sensation and pressure and call it pain for 1 minute, and then it's over, and she has 3 minutes of bliss. Uh-huh. And in that 3 minute period, her body is relaxing and releasing these hormones, all of which pass to the baby. So she gets a recovery and the baby gets a recovery. Uh-huh. But it's in the process of experiencing the sensations that those hormones pass across the placenta. So it's like a euphoria. It could be a euphoria that the sensation's not there anymore, but nonetheless, it's a euphoria. And if you had, you know, 300 contractions in your labor and you had euphoria, that's all passing to the baby, and that's implicating the baby's neurological function and sensory experience for hours and hours and hours and hours. Then a baby's born. It is a rite of passage to be born. You know, it's work. It's hard work to be born. Everything about labor, it's setting us up for life outside the womb. But once that hard work is completed, there is a tremendous surge of euphoria that the woman experiences. And the baby, you know, it's like that first breath, those first breaths, those moments of wonder coming into this world. If that happens without the interventions and the medications, the bonding is extraordinary. There are no words to describe it, you know, and I'm a mother as well, and I didn't have that like deep connection with my baby when she was growing inside me. But the moment she was out, I would have taken a bullet for her. And that's part of our biological imperative. This is how we were formed. This is part of our design. So, you know, when you take an epidural or if you have Pitocin, most women who have Pitocin augmentation, which is the synthetic version of oxytocin. Oxytocin is that hormone that we feel when we experience pleasure and joy and when we're kissing and making love. The synthetic form of Pitocin, the synthetic form of oxytocin called Pitocin, doesn't produce the same response in our body. So most women are having these contractions that are no longer, you know, different and unique, and each one kind of takes us on its own journey. In a Pitocin experience, we're having 2.5 minute contractions, contractions every 2.5 minutes, but they're lasting a minute and a half or 2 minutes, and it's like a jackhammer. And most women automatically get an epidural when that happens because it's just excruciating. There's no endorphins. There's no pleasure. And then they are numbed, and they can no longer feel their baby. They can no longer feel their body. It's a complete disconnect. You know, you could be talking on the phone, watching a movie. You know, it's a disconnect in the experience itself, but the baby is still feeling the jackhammer.
And wow, what a different way to come into the world, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, being at home where you feel safe, you know. I mean, most of my laboring moms, we put them on the toilet. They spend plenty of time there in their own lives. And there's this natural place of surrender and release that happens when you sit on a toilet. Plus, you're in your own environment, which is more suitable for you in terms of your bacteria. It's like your own terrarium is the space that you live in. So we have harmony with our environment, as does our baby, who's been getting antibodies to every single thing that we've come into contact to. So it's actually safer as an environment biologically and physiologically because it's familiar. Whereas a hospital setting, the smells are different. There's a lot of bacteria in a hospital. We know that half of all deaths that happen in a hospital are infection related. So we have a lot more babies that get sick after the delivery because of the environment that they're born into. And they are, you know, women typically don't feel safer in a hospital unless they are of that population that does, which those women I would highly recommend have a hospital birth. But for the most of us, our home is our safe spot, and we're going to do our best work. We're going to dilate faster. We're going to do what needs to get done in labor in that space because it's so familiar and comforting to us. Also, in a hospital setting, you have nurses whom you've never met before. So, you know, it's an entirely foreign experience for most of us. And therefore, really not the ideal place for low-risk women to deliver.
Well, Alex, the way you describe it, it looks like kind of a no-brainer. Why wouldn't every woman want to have the birth at home? Is there an issue here about the insurance companies? Is it that they don't cover home births, or where do we stand in terms of how this gets paid for?
Well, you know, these days insurance is really going through its own metamorphosis, and I think that we're going to end up finding out the more that we go on that, you know, maternity care, although now it's part of Obamacare, I think we're going to find more and more people who don't have the coverage that they think they have. And when you look at the bottom line costs between, you know, midwifery care and hospital birthing, the way that insurance is working now, we're going to have fewer and fewer choices, but we're going to end up paying more and more for giving birth in the hospital. So that I'm hoping that, you know, people really do their research and find out the, what really their hard costs are going to be in the end. I think they're going to find that for what they're paying for their insurance, it'll still be cheaper for them to give birth out of the hospital with midwives while receiving better care and ultimately having a better experience. However, you know, it's going to be some time before the culture of our society really understands the risks associated with out-of-hospital birth because, you know, ACOG, which is the American College of Gynecology and Obstetrics, they're really not pushing for the widespread awareness that people really see the differences. I mean, they're still saying hospital birth is safer than home birth. And study after study after study proves that that is not the truth. It's just not accurate. But it becomes kind of like the smear campaign, which has, you know, been around for the last 100 years. We're, you know, that's not a new tactic in, you know, amassing the culture of our communities to, you know, buy into the concept that hospital birth is safer. You know, you cannot look at these studies and see that it is, you know, but our culture plays on fear. And, you know, the way that doctors are trained, they're not trained to give women informed consent. They're really skewing the information so that, you know, people become good patients instead of empowered choosers of the experience that they're having.
Right, exactly. Well, clearly this is something, if you know any woman or you are pregnant or any, you know, sister, mother, daughter going down that road, definitely you want to look into this, the home birthing and check into the midwife. But given that we're at a point where, you know, we've got 98.8% of the women are still having birth in hospitals, do you have any advice for the women who are going to have a child in hospital, kind of what they can do to make that more of a positive experience to protect themselves and their infant from infection and to restore some of the sanctity of the moment for themselves?
Yes, absolutely. There are two really big things. The first is hire a doula. A doula is somebody who is trained to advocate for women in the hospital birth setting. Sometimes they also do home birth as well. In that case, they're not really there to advocate. They're there to massage and feed and really spell the dad when he needs a break. A doula in the room will cut down C-section by 50%. So they make a huge impact in outcomes. But the other thing I really would encourage people to do is to really make sure that the doctor that they have hired is really looking out for them, not for themselves, not the OB themselves, or necessarily for the hospital protocols. So, you know, I often hear people saying, well, I'm going to see if my doctor will let me. And that statement alone just, I cringe, but it's usually followed by eat or drink during labor or, you know, I really want to let the cord pump with all the blood that's coming from the placenta and not cut right away. I'll see if my doctor will allow me to do these things. And what I would tell my, you know, these people is that you are paying them to work for you. There are plenty of obstetricians out there who, you know, believe in birth as a human rights. Like, it really has become about human rights, and it's about what you want, not what your doctor is going to let you do. You don't need to ask permission. And if you educate yourself on what your options are, you will have a much better experience going into this process. So, you know, they cannot do things without your consent. And so we have to realize that our voice has power. And when we say, no, I do not give my consent to that procedure, in order, if they go against that, then they're breaking a law. And so it's really important for people to know where their power is and to exercise it, because we are the consumer. And when consumers really start standing for what they want, we're going to start seeing trends.
Fantastic. Well, we're at the end of our show here, and I want to thank you for the great work you're doing for the women, for the babies, for the families, and the great sensibility you have about restoring the sanctity to this incredible moment of passage in our lives. How can people find out more information about the Sanctuary Birth and Family Wellness Center?
Check us out at birthsanctuary.com. We have lots of classes and resources for new parents, even people who aren't coming into care with us. We have just so much that we've amassed here to really support people along their path. Dr. Fishbein, who couldn't join us today because he's on his way to a birth, he also does breech deliveries and twins out of the hospital. Most places in the country, if you have a breech baby, you're having a C-section. And we have people that come from all around the world to have their baby with him. So he's pretty awesome, and also has his own blog and podcast. So I would check him out, birthinginstincts.com. And, we have lots of free classes and seminars that we offer to the public. So I would encourage any listener who's in the L.A. area to come check us out. We also have a really neat eco boutique where we sell all sorts of natural products for a new baby and new families.
Okay, great. Well, Alexandra Evangelidi, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to breakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Spretnik will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.